Okay, good morning. Hello and welcome to the Sufi Studies Network Seminar Series for 2023. It is my pleasure to host this event once again. I would first like to start by acknowledging the traditional custodians of the lands on which we meet today. We pay our respect to their elders, past and present, and extend that respect to all Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander peoples today. Our first speaker for the series is Dr. Ken Avery, who will talk about one of Attar's important texts known as the Ilahi-Nameh, sometimes translated as the Book of God or the Book of Divine. Attar, as you know, was a Sufi poet and apothecary who lived, as far as we know, from 1145 to 1221. Now, Ken's talk will be titled From Self-Pride to Self-Criticism, The Ending of Attar's Ilahi-Nameh. He will deliver a 30-minute recorded talk followed by a 10-minute response by Dr. Ashkan Bahrani, and an unrecorded Q&A session that will follow. A little bit about Ken before we begin. Dr. Avery received his PhD in Islamic Studies from the University of Melbourne in 2000. His dissertation became the basis of his first book, published by Routledge in 2004, titled A Psychology of Early Sufi Sama. In 2007, he published his translation and analysis of the 50 poems written by the Persian mystic Fariduddin Attar, who is the focus of today's exciting talk. His monograph on the 10th century Sufi master Al-Shibli was also published by the State University of New York Press in 2014. Dr. Avery's current research projects include a monograph on Bayezid Bastami and on Attar. Ken was also instrumental in the establishment of the weekly Farsi study group last year, co-organized by Monash and WSU, which also focuses on reading Attar. Now, I would like to pass over to Ken to begin his talk. Thank you. Thank you, Ken. Welcome.
Thank you, Milad. And thank you for that introduction. Just before I start, I suppose Attar has been a friend of mine for more than 40 years, on and off. But I still find every time I read him, there is just so much more than what we can understand. It is just so rich. I think he's been overshadowed by Rumi until perhaps recently, when there's been much more attention done to Attar. But I believe he is a very great poet in the Persian tradition, and deserving of much more attention than has been given to him before. So my title today is From Self-Praise to Self-Criticism, The Conclusion of Attar's Ilahi-Nameh. The Ilahi-Nameh, the Divine Book or the Book of God, is one of the four epic masterworks of the great Persian Sufi poet Fariduddin Attar, who died in about 1220 of the Common Era. Though less well known than the author's famous Conference of the Birds, the Ilahi-Nameh is written in a similar style. An overall frame story interlinks with illustrative narratives and anecdotes taken from secular and religious history, folklore, and legend. The frame story is that of a king who has six sons, each seeking worldly pleasure and riches, with the king trying to direct their quest toward spiritual enlightenment. The Ilahi-Nameh is best understood as a work of Sufi practical ethics, as the scholar Ghazal Dabiri has shown. The book mobilizes the formal characteristics of the practical ethics, or the so-called mirrors for princes genre, to appeal to a wide audience in encouraging a Sufi way of life. The work is meant for a broad, non-specialist audience, with no esoteric terminology or lengthy theoretical discourses. It is highly entertaining, with witty tales that are relatable and memorizable. The six princes wish for fame, riches, trinkets, and the power to escape from the responsibilities of their royal birth and social position, a bit like the present-day English Prince Harry. Similarly, this applies to all of the book's readers or listeners who wish to escape from their life circumstances, whether rich or poor. Attar shows that this desire is illusory. The only way to change one's situation is through self-awareness, self-knowledge, and enlightened faith. In this paper, I wish to concentrate on the concluding part of the Ilahinama. Firstly, in the penultimate section, the sixth prince is steered away from his desire for the alchemist's secret toward the quest for true divine alchemy. Attar relates the fable of the male musk deer and its apparently miraculous production of precious musk. Quote, renowned experts say that there is a deer which for 40 days and nights eats wormwood, hay, and thorns, and occasionally seeks out sweet-smelling flowers. When it has passed these 40 days in purity, it turns its head toward the dawn sky at daybreak. When that breath of dawn passes into its lifeblood, musk flows from its navel. From that breath, musk is produced. And because of that breath, musk is sought by many people. Unquote. This fable allows for a sustained metaphor encapsulating themes close to Attar's heart. The 40 days isolation and special diet of the musk deer alludes to the Sufi chilla retreat and fasting. Turning toward the dawn sky and the dawn's breath, changing blood at the navel into a pot of musk, is a metaphor of spiritual transformation. The word for navel in Persian is naf, and the pot of musk is nafar. So a spiritual metaphor as well as a linguistic pun. This is made clearer in the very next couplets. Who would have thought in all the world that such a breath could turn blood into musk in an instant? Since a pure breath can turn blood into musk, it is possible that it can turn dust into a living soul. Indeed, when the light of the real enters into the living being, your body immediately takes on the essential color of that being. Unquote. The fable is a metaphor of God's light entering the living being with the body, taking on the essential color of that human being. The pure breath can turn dust into a living soul, thus alluding to Adam's creation. The metaphor extends to transformation of ordinary worldly existence into the wholeness of the spiritual life and serves as an exemplar of bodily resurrection and the world to come. The dust of death turns into the spirit of life. This is the real alchemy about which Attar pleads that he can speak no further. Quote, what can I say? It is impossible to say more, for I have no authority to speak any further. Unquote. After more than 300 pages, he finally refuses to speak further. Though it is rather amusing that he keeps illustrating this no further with many more passages and pages of stories and teachings. He goes on to say, quote, if you practice alchemy, practice it thus, but practice it in the way of faith. Since this alchemy is not at God's throne or seat, seek it in your own being. Why ask for more? Practice this alchemy if you are deserving of the path, since it is an alchemy for the soul from God. Unquote. Attar says that he has no authority to speak further. But if alchemy is to be sought, it should be found in your own being, Jan, since it is an alchemy for the soul, the Jan, from God. An alternate reading here could be a divine alchemy for the living person. Despite the metaphor of resurrection used earlier in this passage, Attar states boldly that this transformation is not found at God's throne or seat, the divine Arsh or Kursi. In other words, we should not wait in resignation until the afterlife. It is to be sought here and now, quote, in your own being, unquote. Attar then concludes, quote, to tell you mysteries beyond this is not permissible except on the gallows. There are other way stations beyond this, but I do not know if anyone has reports of them. I do not know how to travel that road to my real self, or perhaps by myself, Bahud. For without permission, I cannot even sigh. If permission is given, I may try to explain this, but otherwise it is best if it remains a veiled secret, unquote. He alludes to the martyr mystic Halaj by stressing that to speak of mysteries beyond what he has already said is not allowed unless one is ready for the gallows. He acknowledges the religious, political, and social upheavals brought about by broadcasting the ultimate truths of the Sufi path. In Attar's Memorial of God's Friends, he relates the example of the Inquisition trial initiated by the conservative preacher Ghulam Khalil in Baghdad in the year 877 against Junayd, Nuri, Shibli, and several others. Arraigned on charges of heresy and social nonconformity, these Sufis were saved from the threat of capital punishment by their intimate knowledge of divine law. But he concludes this section of the Ilahinama by saying that there are other way stations, makamat, beyond this about which he has no report. The next chapter of the Ilahinama is entitled Khatimayi Kitab, ending of the book, or epilogue. Khatima being cognate with Arabic khatim, seal or signet ring, as in Khatimul Anbiya, the seal of the prophets. The teaching and substance of the book having been completed, the Khatima is like a wrapping which envelopes the book and parcels it up with a closing seal. But in this, Attar begins to extol and praise his own work quite immodestly. The self-congratulatory acclamation of the value of his own poetry is in the style of a panegyric aimed not at a wealthy patron of the arts, but at himself. Quote, I have made words reach to a place where no other person can arrive. Many virtuous young men will be delighted from night to morning by my gardens of poetry. The person who boasts of his own words, breathing like the dawn from a pure heart, had they lived till my generation, they would have died when they looked at this book. Indeed, when the sun begins to shine, there is not an atom of strength left for the dawn. Since the meter, or the sea, the bah, of my poetry happened to be perfect, thousands of fountains sprang up on the shore. The sun will be darkened on Judgment Day, but this poetry will be resplendent forever. In paradise, beautiful huris will be singing every day with the melody of love. Unquote. For most poets of Attar's generation, writing encomia for princes or courtiers and other wealthy patrons was their professional work which provided their income. Having his own means of support in his pharmacy, Attar did not need to write flattering poems for wealthy benefactors, and he loathed this debasement of the poetic art. Julie Scott Maisami argues that the repetitious nature of panegyric reflects the ritual function of such poetry. The panegyric recited on ceremonial occasions is a ritual text affirming the institution of the state, with the monarch as the center, and the membership of those present in the court in that institution. The ritual nature of such poetry also extended to other less formal social settings of its recitation at the convivial party or entertainment where guests singers, and musicians delighted gatherings of courtiers, officials, and important guests. Just as an aside here, the convivial party was Buzzum or Razum, which is a wonderful sort of play on words in classical Persian. In Attar's case, however, the exaggerated flattery of this chapter may be seen in a different light if, as my Sami argues, poets make others what they are themselves. Thus, by the art which makes them immortal, they confer immortality on those whom they celebrate. This view of panegyric upgrades the poet's task from one of flattery to one of immortalization, and thus assumes its value. Muhammad Isa Wali also mentions the tradition of mubalaga, or exaggeration, as a fundamental character of Persian poetry, to which Attar was not averse. In nearly all poetic genres, the use of exaggeration was typical and widespread among many authors over the whole history of classical and post-classical Persian verse. It may seem out of character for an otherwise modest Sufi to praise and extol his own poetic gifts, but it was not for selfish or egotistical reasons that he did this. It was rather his quest for the immortality and transcendence of his poetry, advancing his shir, poetry, to be on a par with shar, divine law, and arsh, divine throne. This identification allows for the transpositional pun on the letters shin, ayin, and ra, as found in Attar's Musibat Nama, the Book of Afflictions. Quote, poetry, law, and throne arose as one, so they could with three letters adorn the two worlds. Unquote. Rafael Stepien argues that for Attar, poetry comes from the same source as divine wisdom as a whole, shar, and that poetry is nothing less than what God knows and is. One of the motives for Persian poets to compose panegyric was the hope of reward from their satisfied patrons upon hearing their name being eulogized. For Attar, who had no wealthy prince or courtier to please, the end of this panegyric chapter consists of several lines where he speaks of his own contentment and self-sufficiency. Quote, since I am imprisoned beneath this turquoise dome, I am perfectly content in the world with a single home. What would I do with the length and breadth of the world, the blueness of the sky, and the expanse of the earth? The kingdom which I already have is sufficient for me, and if I should need anything, it is only wild rue. Since I am the sovereign in the kingdom of contentment, I am always able to do as I wish. Unquote. His contentment and freedom of action may well refer to his practice of the poetic craft, his freedom from the constraints of court poets. This theme continues in the next section of the Khatima, where he briefly alludes to the miserable fee paid by Sultan Mahmud of Ghazna to Firdausi for writing his famous epic, the Shahnama, the Book of Kings. Again, Attar is thankful for his independence and not needing a patron for his living. Quote, praise be to God that I am mature in the faith, and in the world I am not beholden to anyone. I have more than enough of the things I need. Why would I stretch out my hand for this and that? Unquote. From a position of contentment and self-sufficiency, Attar moves into his more typical stance of despondency and self-deprecation in the next section of the Khatima. This is more typical because discontent and regret is the usual mood of his poetry, whether in his lyrical divan or in the Mathnavis. He begins this next section with, quote, a worshipper of the real, one who was familiar with mysteries, spoke thus. For everything which you have and need, it is better that you are free of it all. There is nothing in either world for which you would be better off if it didn't exist, unquote. The anonymous worshipper of the real may be simply a device to cloak his own teaching in the name of another. In any case, he immediately launches into a long section bemoaning his lack of a companion, a soulmate with whom he can confide his deepest thoughts. But the pain of this gives rise to his poetry. Quote, "Since I have no one as my companion, I speak of my grief in that book. I have a solitary pain in the depths of my heart, which gives birth to all these words. Whether I speak little or much, why would I seek another person? I speak to myself." Unquote. This regret at not having a soulmate is echoed famously by Rumi at the beginning of his Mathnavi in the Song of the Reed. But for Attar, his loneliness leads him to self-criticism and denunciation. He addresses his own heart, quote, "O heart, since your companions are gone, your friends and associates all departed, how long will you pursue useless causes? Be gone. How long will you procrastinate? Do what you must when you still have time today. Light a fire while you still have a flame. All are asleep, whether drunk or sober. When will you awaken from your sleep? Why do you travel on the giddy roundabout of words? Step into the realm of mystic states if you are courageous. Since you have spent all your precious life in talking, when will you act? I see that poetry is always your idol. You have no occupation but idol worship." Unquote. From the panegyric of excessive self-praise, Attar swings to the extreme opposite of denunciation and regret, where poetry is not a divine pursuit, but mere idolatry. In the next section, he continues this theme of idolatry, telling the story of a would-be ascetic who made a fetish of preparing for death by digging a grave and readying a shroud. Quote, "For such a person whose asceticism is beyond bounds, grave and shroud are like so many veils that hide. Your veil began with poetry, for by this idol you are separated from God. I broke many different types of idol, but now I am an idol worshipper of my poetry." Unquote. Here again, the author addresses himself to make accusation against his own failures. He ends this section with a reproach of the tongue and praise for muteness. This extends his criticism of the wordiness of poetry and also alludes to the inner silence and muteness of altered state experience. Quote, "You were a tongue for far too long. Now, like true heroes, make yourself all ear from head to foot. Many are the misfortunes which befall the speaker because of their tongue. Since gold is mute, it finds honor in that." Tomorrow on Judgment Day, of all your limbs, it is your tongue which the judge will shackle. The lily has attained freedom because it chose muteness despite having 10 tongues. Since you will become silent as the mountains, do not let the froth on your lip become agitated like the ocean. Unquote. Attar continues his themes of regret and self-criticism for several more pages of the Khatima until the final short story, in which he strikes a more positive and sweet-scented ending for the Ilahinama. He relates that Bishr al-Hafi, a mendicant Sufi who died in Baghdad about 841, once found the name of God written on a scrap of paper lying on the road. He immediately sold his only possession, a single grain of gold, and bought musk with which he perfumed the scrap of paper. That night, he dreamed that he heard a heavenly voice saying that because he raised God's name from the dust and perfumed it, he has been made a seeker of truth. and has himself been sweet-scented and purified by God. In this gentle story, the mention of the word perfumed, muatta, allows for wordplay with the poet's name. And so the book ends with these four couplets. Quote, O God, this sweet singing attar has greatly sweet scented your name with the fragrance of poetry. But what was attar sweet singing? For hasn't your name always been sweet scented? Still by your grace, make him the dust of your door. By your name, make him famous. For apart from your grace, he has no prospect, if he has not a whisper of obedient devotion. Unquote. So to conclude, in the epilogue of this book, Attar begins with a panegyric of self-praise and flattery, then swings back to his more usual mood of regret and self-censure. His exaggerated self-praise is not egotistical, but a quest for immortality and transcendence. The oscillation between flattery and regret also shows his ambivalent and uncertain attitude to his art. At times, he claims it is fit for the heavenly realm. At other times, he disparages its value as mere verbiage. He seems embarrassed that his art is at the same time sublime, yet also demeaning. This contradiction gives us an insight into Attar's temperament. The emotional seesaw witnessed in many of the ghazals in his divan is repeated in the Khatima as he oscillates between elation and despair. This conclusion to the Ilahinama sheds light on the poet's attitude to his art, the motivation for his writing, and his psychological temperament, providing a rare insight into these more personal aspects of his life and work. Thank you for listening.
Thank you, Ken. That was really nice. Really appreciate it. Now we have a response from Ashkan. Would you like to
comment? Thank you so much, Dr. Milani. Thank you so much, Dr. Avery. I really enjoyed reading and listening to your great presentation, Dr. Avery. I am fascinated by a few topics in your presentation. I just start with one technical topic regarding translation of some key terms in Attar, and then jump into three main points in terms of the content. Regarding the translation, I think one thing about translating Attar is of great importance because he combines the high literary standard as well as a clearly colloquial tone. So when we want to translate his works, as you have done and previously Helmut Ritter and John O'Kane, for example, did, it is very important to use Eugene Nida's language to have a kind of, let's say, dynamic equivalence rather than formal equivalence, as if we translate as if we are translating for the audience of his own time, the way that the audience of his own time understood. To give but one example, the way that you explored and explained the word John in works of Attar and the way that previously Ritter did is of great importance, because if we want to have a formal equivalence and translate it all the time as soul or spirit, it doesn't resonate with modern contemporary readers. But the way that you shift between soul and living being is very, very helpful and impressive. That's one thing regarding the translation. I'm also intrigued by Dr. Avery's talk on Attar's Elahinameh in how he addresses three main subjects. Attar's economic independence from the royal fiscal resources, his ambivalence between self-praise and self-critic, and reading Elahinameh as a bona fide example of Sufi practical ethics. In my response, I will attend to them one by one, trying to continue and expand them briefly within the limits of my knowledge and time, in conversation with Attar's other books of epic poetry, including his Book of Affliction and Conference of Birds. As Dr. Ivor articulated, in contrast to the submissive attitude towards political authorities, Attar dedicates none of his works to a king or ruler of the day. Attar is a critic of kings and rulers' hypocrisy throughout his works, and that can be seen in a relatively cautious way in the Divine Book. This critic, however, in the final analysis, leads to an opposition to both the contemporary social ethics of his day as well as the rulers. Unlike what Helmut Ritter and more recently Claudia Yagubi have suggested, this theology of political dissidence reflected in works such as the Book of Affliction, and to a lesser degree in Divine Book, doesn't lead to a conventional submission to the divine either. In contrast, Attar takes an exceptional theological stance among his fellow Asharite Sufis by leaving the problem of proliferated suffering in the world as an unanswered and unanswerable dilemma. As for ambivalence, it is also a theological and artistic technique. At first, it overflows just spontaneously, as is evident in his concluding remarks, the ending of Elahinameh. Still, he also benefits from it, as Dr. Avery mentioned, consciously as a means to an end, to show the ambivalence in human nature, the inadequacy of poetry and theological language, and the unanswered questions about divine justice. Seeing his Divine Book in a broader picture in a conversation with his other works of epic poetry, most significantly, his underappreciated work, The Book of Affliction, highlights this ambivalence, straddling between self-praise and self-critic, conformity and discontent, consensus and contention, sobriety and intoxication, sanity and madness. Like his successor, like his spiritual successor, Jalaluddin Rumi, Attar deserves to be credited with mastery in the application of complaining about the inadequacy of poetic language as a linguistic technique to elaborate on the ineffable, to speak of the unspeakable. Taking advantage of this poetic device can be understood along with his usage of oxymorons and paradoxical language in his discourse on the divine. As for his political, mystical, ascetic theology and ethical enterprises, however, in comparison to the Book of Affliction and to a lesser degree the Conference of Birds, Attar takes a relatively conservative position in his Divine Book. It is good to remember the book's alternative title, namely Khosrownameh, or the Book of the Emperor. In Elahinameh or Khosrownameh, the king epitomizes the well-known paragon of the wise ruler, or as it is expressed in Persian or any Islamic languages, Hakim-e-Hakim, who represents the interior knowledge of religion and the mundane exterior disciplines of rulership. It is necessary, however, to bring this identification of emperor with the wise ruler to a critical conversation with his most ruthless critic of the political authorities, expressed by the most favorite characters of his anecdotes, namely the wise fools. Reading through Attar's divine book, some passages condone a conventional Asherite theological standpoint. Some of them, of course. Thus, it is not surprising to find some residues of Asherite theory of divine justice in Attar. For instance, in a passage, he denies the presence of evil in the world altogether. Instead, he takes a conventional Asherite position that sees evil as the result of theological myopia and a one-dimensional point of view. Similarly, when it comes to the question of divine omnipotence, there are passages in which he advocates the idea of God as all-powerful at the expense of depicting humanity as devoid of free will and submissive to divine providence. That's why I'm saying that compared to other works, Elahiname represents a relatively conservative approach towards his theological concerns. The most illustrative example is an anecdote in Elahiname where Al-Bastami responds to the conversion of a Christian to Islam. Again, this version is slightly but significantly different from what Attar narrates in Tazkiratul Awliya, in his memorial. Quote, a Christian wearing a cross belt came to Al-Bastami in the market. He converted to Islam and abandoned Da'at. Afterwards, he tore apart his cross belt. The master burst into tears when he saw the convert who tore his cross belt apart. Someone asked him, oh, my master, why did you burst into tears when you should have been joyful? I cried, replied Al-Bastami, because I thought how fair it would be that after 7 years, he tied down his cross belt and turned his loss to benefit in the blink of an eye. What would I do if God made me put on that cross belt? That's why I'm crying. And what could we do if he made somebody else put on the cross belt that man has just torn apart? If it's wrong to break a cross belt, why would it be wrong to put on a cross belt? Unquote. The last few lines clearly resonates with his cautious and ambivalent conclusion at the end of Elahinama, of course. So again, as Dr. Avery mentioned, we can find this ambivalence, this fluctuation between protest and contentment throughout his work, most importantly in Elahiname, in which he's a little bit more willing to stay with the Asherite conventional theory of divine justice. Thank you very much.
Thank you.